I'm Zarina Golda Musni. I'm a human rights lawyer from the Philippines. Professionally, I'm a member of the National Union of People's Lawyers, as well as the Union of People's Lawyers in Mindanao, where I come from. Personally, I'm a daughter of two human rights lawyers and a sister of two human rights activists as well. And I was born and raised in the Philippines, where I was active in my activism since I was maybe in high school, starting in high school and then on until law school until now. Now I am here based in Europe for reasons of political persecution against human rights lawyers in the Philippines. So thank you for having me. There are two ways, or at least there are two ways. While being at a distance from home, you bring the stories from home in Europe. So that's how you can raise the public awareness, at least in the European level, on what's going on in the Philippines. So that's one. Second is you bring the European actors to the Philippines and you bring the attention to the Philippines. But not just attention, but support. Or even more so legal action if that's necessary or that's possible, no? So there are two ways to do this. As we say, in so doing, we also create a pressure sandwich in the Philippines, no? That while we continue to raise the public awareness, international awareness on what's going on in the Philippines, being outside the Philippines in the international arena, you call on the international community to listen, to look at the situation in the Philippines in order to pressure the Philippine government to uphold, protect, and defend the human rights of the Filipino people, as is its duty. During the Duterte administration, he was very public in the sense that he said publicly that I don't care about human rights. So the violations on human rights were as rampant as his statements. Maybe that's the reason why international community has set its eyes on the Duterte administration. In the Marcos administration, Marcos Jr. administration that we have now, somehow he has a way of presenting himself diplomatically, which is very different from how Duterte presented himself in public. So and more so that during in Marcos Jr.'s time, he appeals to the international community in a very friendly and diplomatic way, which is very different from how Duterte dealt with international community, if he ever did. So with Marcos, you would say that, oh, with what he's saying in television, with how he's presenting the Philippines to the international community, perhaps the human rights situation has improved. For us on the ground, it's not as it seems. For sure, there is continuing violations, there are continuing killings, may not be the same extent as during Duterte's administration, especially under his war on drugs. But still, the killings continue. The abductions continue. The trumped-up cases, the filing of trumped-up cases continue. The weaponization of the law continues. So there may have been differences in how the forms of violation come in during this administration of Marcos Jr., But the situation remains, no? That there is rampant violation of human rights in the Philippines, so that the movement for human rights defense and promotion still continues to persist. There is no backing down, no? of our assertion and defense of human rights, because it may sound better now during Marcos Jr., but it's not so on the ground.
When we discuss the human rights situation in the Philippines, there's always a term that comes to the agenda, which is red tagging. No? What can you tell us about red tagging? What is like red tagging? And also what is like the legal and institutional infrastructure that surrounds it? No?
Yes. To be sure, red tagging is not new. Red tagging is a form of labeling civilians, human rights defenders, as part of the red movement, which would refer to the communist movement or the progressive movement in the Philippines. If I'm not mistaken, it started with McCarthyism in the U.S. when then Senator McCarthy red tagged the civil rights movement in the U.S., labeling them as part of the communist group, precisely the same as is happening in the Philippines. However, what's different is that it was more intensified during the Duterte administration when he implemented declared the executive order number 70 or EO-70, no, for short. This EO-70 institutionalized the red tagging practice in the Philippines with the creation of the National Task Force to End Local Communist Armed Conflict. The background of this is that for every president in the Philippines, there's always that promise at the start of the term that in my term, I will end the communist insurgency during my 6-year stint as a president. There's always that so-called promise of the new president. For Duterte administration, it was this EO-70. With the creation of the National Task Force to End Local Communist Armed Conflict, it was through this institution, it was through this task force with partnership of the Department of National Defense, with the partnership of Department of Budget and many other government institutions. It formalized red tagging in the sense that it was more official, no? So they used all the state apparatus to further this red tagging. When I say to further, it was because with the creation of the, before the EO-70, the red tagging persists without someone talking to it, like formally. So we would see like the forms of red tagging in tarpaulins without any signatories. To be sure, red tagging would come in the form of leaflets, no, that stating a person like Zarina Musni or NUPL or UPLM, my organizations, as part of communist movement or communists themselves, so that people would be wary of them. And these leaflets, these banners, would have no one as its signatory. But now, with the National Task Force to End Local Communist Armed Conflict, or to be short, NTFL-CAC, they would use their partners in the media, the SMNI networks, to really red tag in public, like, no, we as the NTFL-CAC, we identify UPLM as a communist front. So now it's really shown who is doing the red tagging. Before, we know that it was the government, but there was no face to it. But now there is. Maybe it's a positive thing, because now we know that it is really the government that's doing this persecution against civil rights movement. So this is the legacy that the Duterte has left during his presidency, apart from his bloody war on drugs, this red tagging. When you are red tagged, you are labeled as communist, or worse, as a combatant, as a member, as a combatant, as a commander of a battalion of the New People's Army. And that's different. That's already crossing the line. That's already violating the blurring the lines of international humanitarian law, blurring the lines of a civilian and a combatant. So that's one. So what happens is that when you're being red tagged, the impact on the people being red tagged is that, oh, I'm a combatant already. That's the message that it wants to send to the public, that he or she, Zarina Musni, is a combatant. And so whatever happens to her, it's because she's a combatant, which is not true. No, we may be staunch human rights defenders, but we are not bringing arms as if we may have arms in the sense that we have our legal knowledge, we have our expertise in the law, but it's not the firearms that we go into the mountains with. So that's one of the important impact that it has on the society, that it blurs the line with between a civilian and a combatant. Second, on the institutions, on the persons, on the organizations being red tagged, it silences your dissent. It cripples you to continue your human rights movement. And this is a shame because, for example, for our organization, for the National Union of People's Lawyers and the Union of People's Lawyers in Mindanao, we provide our legal services for free to the marginalized and oppressed sectors of society who cannot afford effective and quality legal services. So when we are red tagged, we are also crippled in the sense that the people may be afraid in availing of our services, or our members are afraid in providing services to the people. So there is the two-way impact, no? Just a particular on my organizations, that not only are we impacted in providing the services, which is very much needed in the defense and promotion of human rights of the people, but also the people would not want to pursue the defense and promotion of their rights through the services of lawyer because, these lawyer, these are communists, these are combatants, these are enemies of the state. So there goes your continuous violations of people's human rights without seeking for justice and accountability because lawyers are also being attacked. The red tagging impacted so much the peasants and the indigenous people's communities because they were the ones who were asserting their right to land and to ancestral domain. But what's also important is that they're linked to the armed conflict. The armed conflict in the Philippines is between the Communist Party of the Philippines and the Republic of government of the Republic of the Philippines. The armed from the Communist Party, there is the New People's Army, which is their armed wing, and this armed wing is more more visible or has its more presence in the mountainous areas, in the peasant communities. So when you red tag an indigenous people's communities, it's easy for the government to label them directly because you're in the mountains, you're easily connected to the battalion already behind that mountain of Mount Apo. So, and because they are away, they are at a big, huge different distance from the society, they cannot easily expose these red tagging violations against themselves. So somehow it impacted them in the sense that while they are not armed combatants, but they are human rights defenders in respect to their ancestral domains. So this red tagging also silenced them, also crippled them, that they do not want anymore to be part of organizations that would defend their ancestral domains, because then the military would come to their communities, would stay in their communities, and would ravage their land and ravage even their women. So somehow, the impact also is harsh on the peasant, on the indigenous people's communities. Lumad women are also in the front lines of the defense of the ancestral domains, because they are the ones who also take care of their crops. In one of the films that we've shown here in Barcelona, we were taught, although this is the tribal communities in the north, but very similar to what we have in the south, it's that principle that women were the ones who plant the crops. Because to their knowledge, to their culture, because women are the child bearers, they would be in the best position to plant crops as child bearers, as bearers of life. So that's why they are the women, indigenous women, are in the forefront of the defense of ancestral domains and their culture and tradition, no? But with the militarization of communities, with the bombings of communities, women are very much threatened because, one, we have had stories and documented cases of rape in these communities, sexual harassment by the military of women and young girls. In terms of bombings, when the communities are being bombed, it's like you're committing genocide, because then you're targeting indiscriminately, whether they're men, women, and children. And when you target women, you also target the killing of a whole tribe, of a whole ethnicity. So that's the end all and be all of all these bombings of communities, not to eradicate these ethnic communities so that they will get out of their land, and so the extractivist projects can come in without any hindrance. The ideal world would have to be where there is no more human rights defenders, where there would be no organizations such as the Union of People's Lawyers in Mindanao, where there would be no organizations as Asociación Catalana por la Paz or International Action for Peace, because in that ideal world, there was no violation of human rights. Everyone is at peace. Every human right is protected, is defended, is respected. But we all know that we don't live in such an ideal world. But we have structures, no? We've got rules, we've got laws, we've got mechanisms that somehow define how a dignified life should be lived. And these are the basics. Right to live freely, right to education, right to health, right to freedom of association, freedom of speech. But again, we know that all these freedoms, all these rights have a boundary. So still we have to respect all those boundaries. And we have to learn to respect each other for a peaceful coexistence. But in order to do so, somehow we have to assert our rights as well, because others may be very comfortable and very strong would not be the term, but how do you say it? Like, that they would be too strong in the sense to the point of they do not care if they would step on other people's shoes, if they would step on other people's rights, so that they would serve their own in the service of their own interests. And so that's why we also need, in this world today, we need human rights defenders. We need everyone of us to be human rights defenders. It should not just be limited to lawyers, not just limited to organizations. No, every one of us should be human rights defenders. It doesn't take too much. It's not a special sector that only serves or caters to a certain type of people to become a human rights defender. We should all be human rights defenders. For everyone to live a dignified life, as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights would say, no, that everyone deserves a dignified life. And with that, I leave you with a Tagalog, which also translated in Bisayan quote. In Tagalog, we would say, makibaka, wag matakot. Makigbisog, ayaw kahadlok. It means, fight and struggle, do not fear. This would refer to asserting your rights, asserting a life of dignity and honor, that you have nothing to fear in this world of capitalism, this world of imperialism, in this world of oppression and exploitation. We, the people, would have nothing to lose but our chains. A week or 2 weeks ago, the Senate and the Congress in the Philippines initiated the QuadCom hearings, committees on good governance, on public accountability and everything. Four committees on the Congress launched a hearing to investigate the extrajudicial killings happened during Duterte's war on drugs. And in those sessions, different resource persons were invited, including members of the police, Philippine National Police, families of the victims of extrajudicial killings, lawyers of the victims. And then they invited former President Rodrigo Duterte to the hearing, which he went. And in that hearing, he spilled the beans. He spilled the beans, like, yes, we had to kill. We had to kill these drug addicts, because otherwise they would become the menace to society and all that. It's not the precise terms, but if you watch the congressional hearings where he was there, he spilled the beans that indeed he was the mastermind of all the killings perpetrated under the war on drugs. And precisely, this is the statement. This statement was on record, no? Because this is official. This is on record. This is accessible to the public. And this precisely is the statement that we believe that the ICC needs, the International Criminal Court needs, to complete its investigation that indeed the extrajudicial killings under the war on drugs was a systematic and widespread killings perpetrated under the policy of President Rodrigo Duterte, so that these killings, the accountability of these killings, would not just be the police officers serving the warrant, would not just be the police officers, the chief of the PNP who was sitting at that. It was not just the, I don't know, the chief of the drug enforcement agency, no, but it would all roads would lead to Rodrigo Duterte being the head, being the mastermind of this policy that implemented all these war on drugs, on these killings under the war on drugs, so that he and all his minions would have to be made accountable by the ICC. So the two domestic and international proceedings are very much related to each other without prejudice to each other. There may be comments against ICC investigation. Of course, the camp of Duterte would say, "Ah, there the investigation are already being pursued in the domestic arena. So why do we need the ICC to intervene? These foreigners, they have no right to intervene in the Philippines because we have a robust justice system happening in the Philippines." But we as human rights lawyers and human rights defenders would still support the pursuance of the ICC investigation, because we believe that while the justice system is going on, with is the wheels of the justice system in the Philippines is rolling, no, is at its work to investigate Duterte and his minions on the war on drugs, still we believe that it may still be subject to influence, or it may not be enough to really hold them accountable for all these killings, so that the need for the ICC to investigate and come in is all the more pressing and important. So we continue our support to the ICC prosecutor, the Office of Karim Khan, to pursue its investigation in the Philippines, and perhaps sooner or later to issue the warrant of arrest, or if not the subpoena, against Rodrigo Duterte and his minions to answer for his accountability in the killings under the war on drugs. A funny statement that Rodrigo Duterte said during the Senate hearing was that, "Oh, ICC, bilisan niyo na yan. Like, hurry up, ICC, before I die." So that's what he said during congressional hearings. And the Senate President, Senator Chis Escudero, did say that it's ironic why Rodrigo Duterte said that, when he, in fact, was the one who stalled The investigation of the ICC by withdrawing the Philippines from the Rome Statute, making it challenging for the ICC to continue its investigation on his war on drugs. And yet now, he's saying, oh, ICC, bilisan nyo na yan. Hurry up, ICC, come over. Come over here and arrest me. Or if you need to arrest me, come over, hurry up the proceedings. So it's, we really can't understand what's going on in Duterte's head, no? Why he withdrew the Philippines from the Rome Statute and now making all these statements, hurrying up ICC. So, but we remain hopeful that with all these his ramblings in public television, his ramblings during Senate and congressional hearings would pin him down for his accountability for the war on drugs. The martial law in Mindanao was declared after the Marawi siege in May. The Marawi siege was made by the Duterte administration, by Duterte himself, on the allegation that there were forces from the ISIS present in Marawi. So, at first, he declared martial law in Marawi, the Islamic city of Marawi in Western Mindanao, to somehow, allegedly, to contain the ISIS forces in Marawi. In the end, we cannot be so sure now if there were ISIS forces in Marawi, but we can be very sure that the Islamic city of Marawi has been destroyed, laid down to ruins, and its people being displaced and still do not have access to recompensation for what has been done to their families, to their properties, and to their cities. But after the siege of Marawi, Duterte extended the martial law to whole of Mindanao, saying that there are other terrorist groups in Mindanao other than the ISIS. And for these other terrorist groups, he referred to either the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, or the, I think it was at that time, the Bangsamoro Islamic Freedom Fighters, or more particularly with the New People's Army. So with that, with the extension of martial law in Mindanao, it was the start already of the shrinking of civil spaces insofar as the civil rights movement in Mindanao were concerned. I remember that we had to undergo curfew when we were providing relief and rehabilitation services to Marawi and going back to Cagayan de Oro. At the same time, we were also experiencing curfews and indiscriminate checkpoints when we were providing services to peasant communities in Bukidnon. So this the extension or the implementation of martial law in Mindanao really affected the human rights movement insofar as Mindanao is concerned, given that Mindanao is one of the, if not the, well, it's not the poorest, no, but one of the poorest islands in the Philippines, which needed a lot of help and assistance, not just from the government, but of course from civil society. And that hampered our work, and that hampered the resistance of the Filipino people, or at least from the Mindanao point of view. The current president that we have now is Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr. He is the son of the late dictator Ferdinand Marcos, who ruled the Philippines with an iron hand during 1972 to until he was catapulted out of power in 1986. So around, they say around 20 years, if I'm not mistaken in my math, but around 20 years of Marcos Sr.'s rule in the Philippines. The Marcos dictatorship in the 1970s until the 1980s is important in Philippine history in the sense that it was during his term that intense human rights violations was also committed. And it was during this term, especially in the late 70s to early 80s, that activism, especially amongst the youth, was seen. That was why it was the there was a rise of the organization Kabataang Makabayan, patriotic youth, to denounce all these human rights violations that were committed under the Marcos Sr. dictatorship, as well as the imposition of neoliberal policies in the Philippines and the rampant cronyism and corruption during Marcos Sr.'s time. And the activism that was led by Kabataang Makabayan is important because this activism also continues to this day. To this day, there still remains the fight to call for accountability for the Marcoses for their human rights violations during the Senior's father's dictatorship in the 1970s. This is important because now during the Marcos Jr. presidency, there is an attempt to revise history, to erase that there was no human rights violations done during the father's dictatorship time, that there was no corruption during his time, the father's time, that there was no cronyism that was committed during his time, and that the time of Marcos Sr. was the golden era of the Philippines. In fact, in the history books in the Philippines now, there is an attempt to erase the word dictator that comes before the term Marcos Sr., so that the young students, the youth of Filipino today, would not be knowledgeable on the Philippine history insofar as the dictatorship of the Marcos father is concerned in the past. So this is important to acknowledge that there is this effort to revise history, no? To erase the human rights violations committed during the Marcos Sr.'s dictatorship in order to present a clean slate of the Marcoses for today's generation. And for them, this is important because this would give them a fresh start to continue holding on to power. Especially that elections are coming in for the midterm elections in 2025, where we see son of the Marcoses or the nephew of the Marcoses, the nephews of the Romualdeses. Romualdez is the family of former First Lady Imelda Marcos, no? The wife of former Marcos and the mother of our president now. So there is that attempt, continuous attempt, to stay in power by the Marcoses. And this is interesting to note that today in the Philippines, the Marcoses are already in disunity with the Dutertes. We may recall that in the 2022 national elections, Bongbong Marcos, the son of the former dictator, and Sara Duterte, the son of the former President Rodrigo Duterte, formed a uni-team when they filed for candidacy and ran for president and vice president, respectively. And they won. Of course they won, because they are the top two oligarchs. They're the top two wealthiest families in the Philippines. Maybe not top two, but included in the top tier, no? Oligarchs in the Philippines. So they, and with their resources and their power and their influence, they could easily amass the votes that they needed to catapult them into power. So that was their slogan, that was their tagline in 2022 that they were a unit team. But if you follow the Philippine news now, you would see that there is no more unit team. In fact, how do you say it? There is the colloquial term that there is the war against kadiliman or darkness versus kasamaan or evil. So the kadiliman would be the Marcoses, or the kasamaan would be the Dutertes, or other way around, still the same. But this comes to show that there is already that disunity amongst the between the Marcoses and the Dutertes, and this is a show of their hunger for power, hunger for position. And whilst doing that, the Philippine people are suffering high rising prices, prices of commodities, loss of income, loss of jobs, continuing human rights violations, environmental degradation. While the oligarchs, whether Dutertes and Marcoses, are concerned of their filling up their pockets or clinging into power, it's the Filipino people who is suffering at the moment. So this is the circus that's happening in the Philippines. While it's also good to see that there is already the changing of the times, no? That what we saw during the Duterte administration was that the Dutertes and all of their cronies are, what is the term? Impenetrable. Untouchables. You cannot attack them. You cannot question them. Now there is a change that they are being questioned by Senate. Sara Duterte is now subject to two complaints for impeachment as we speak. Former President Duterte is under investigation for his extrajudicial killings for the war on drugs. So the tides have changed. In a way, it's good because then it seeks accountability for the Duterte's violations. But it should not also veer us away from the issue of the Marcoses also with their violations against the people. Because in fact, the people are continue to suffer. What is striking now is this weaponization of the law. Weaponization of the terrorism laws. The twin laws, we would call them. The Anti-Terror Law and the Terrorist Financing Act. As we speak, there are at least five non-government organizations that I know of that have been arbitrarily charged with terrorist financing cases because of their work with the marginalized and oppressed sectors of society. These are organizations that provide humanitarian services, that provide educational services, that provide relief and rehabilitation missions to far-flung communities in the Philippines that serve the communities when the government cannot. And these are the organizations that are being targeted by these unfair, vague, arbitrary laws of Anti-Terrorism and Terrorist Financing Act. When the real terrorists are out there in power, not being held accountable. The weaponization of the law, the use of these anti-terror laws against the organizations is not just impacting the organizations and the human rights movement. In the sense that when these cases are being filed, when these judicial harassments are being committed, the workers are suspended. The operations are suspended the organizations are the operations of the organizations are being suspended. So they cannot work. They cannot continue to fulfill their missions and visions as an organization. But what's more important is that the communities that they serve are deprived of the well-needed assistance and services that they cannot get from the government itself. Where does the who benefits from all this? No one. It's just the government that benefits it in their so-called promise to end terrorism during their presidency, to end the communist insurgency during their presidency. In the end, it's the people that suffers again by this unjust use, unjust weaponization of the law against the people. These laws should be reviewed. These laws should be amended and even junked if the only use of these laws is to suppress and persecute the very people that help the majority of the Filipino people. So, as a call to the international community, one of this would be to take a look at how these laws are being used in the Philippines. If they are being used really against the terrorist, or is it just being used as a facade to control the narrative, to control the inflow of funds, to control who helps the people? Because in the end, the use of these terrorism laws is not just happening in the Philippines. It happens all around the world. It happens in Costa Rica. It happens in Tbilisi in Georgia. Maybe it happens here in Spain. I'm not so sure. But it happens all around the world. It happens in Africa. So there is a trend, no? The international community can very much make use of such a study as an analysis in the internationalist point of view that these types of laws may be used as a tool for perpetrating imperialism, perpetrating neoliberal neo-colonies. So it's not just happening in the Philippines, but of course, as a Filipina, I would call on the international community to look into the Philippines, to continue to call out the use of this weaponization of the use of these terrorism laws against the Filipino people, but also to relate this to other struggling peoples around the world who are also similarly suffering from these fates of being suppressed by the use of these terrorism laws. The Philippines is strategically at a good location in terms of the West Philippine Sea and in its relation in the Asia Pacific. But this tension between the Philippines and China and the US must also be seen at an internationalist point of view, in the sense that there is the rising imperialist power or competition to US imperialism, which is China and Russia, and its partnership with North Korea. And this is why we see that the US is also scrambling, no? Or doing its best to maintain its control in the Asia Pacific. The West Philippine Sea, as we call it, is one of the main thoroughfares in terms of international waters. And if that part of the waters would be controlled by China, imagine how much it would affect US economy and US control, US hegemony in the region. So because of this competition of imperialist powers, we would say that China is a rising imperialist power, no? Threatening the hegemony of US in international arena. The Philippines now is in a strategic location in terms of being a partner to the US and many other alliances under the US network. So with its partnership with the US, we have under the Marcos administration, we have now the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, or the EDCA, which allowed the US to maintain and add military bases in the Philippines in its support, quote unquote, to the Philippines if China would attack the Philippines. Somehow, this addition of military bases in the Philippines, maintenance and addition of military bases in the Philippines, and the continuous conduct of balikatan exercises, shoulder to shoulder, no? Balikatan, balikat is shoulder in Tagalog. So balikatan, shoulder to shoulder with US military, with the Philippine military, it may seem to be a provocation by the Chinese to start war. May not be as huge as what we are seeing in the Middle East, but it can be a strategic war in the Asia Pacific. So that's why we've seen, like, the Philippines is caught in the crossfires between the US, China, Russia, and also with France and Australia, I believe, is also part in the, and Japan, part of that agreement with the US. And for us, it may not be, it's unfair for us to be in the middle of this imperialist war when in fact the people are fighting against imperialism. And now we're joining an imperialist power against an imperialist power. Because on our own, I don't think that China would attack the Philippines. We're just a small country. We're a very friendly nation. We just wanted to have our own independence from being a neo-colony of the US. We wanted to have our independence against neoliberal policies of the US. And yet we find ourselves in the middle of the war between China and the US. So somehow this war between US and China, we also have to give it a perspective, no? That while we're not pro China, we're also not pro US. At least that's from the people's point of view, that leave these wars because we have our war on our own. We have that civil war in the Philippines with the Communist Party of the Philippines and the Philippine government. Let's focus on that because that concerns the Filipino people first and foremost. It addresses the issue on landlessness and poverty, the development of the Filipino nation, instead of focusing on all these wars that could kill all the Filipinos. So with that, I think it's good to be listening and studying analysis of internationalist experts on how these wars affect the Philippines as a small country, but being in a geopolitical and strategic location as it stands.